Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
People are very clearly more and more saying they don't want chemicals and drugs in their food system. That is so clear. It's so loud and clear. And the mainstream beef industry is still not getting that message. So I'm really hoping my book will be received by the beef industry as a really constructive criticism of how to go forward in a positive way.
Nicolette Hahn-Nyman is herself a rancher. We look at the problem of increasing debt for farmers with Harvest Public Media. Radishes and kale on the plate with Daniel Orr, both recipes are vegan. And what are we really talking about when we talk about GMOs? It's off to Colorado for that story. We start the week's food news with an update from Washington with Mark Chilla.
This week, the Senate Agriculture Committee voted 14-6 for a bill that would preempt state laws requiring labels on food made with genetically modified organisms. Committee Chairman Pat Roberts, who spearheaded the bill, said the move would prevent what he called a patchwork of state label laws across the country. SR 332 would block a law passed in Vermont that takes effect in July. On Monday night before the meeting, Roberts told Politico that the federal law had to be pushed through quickly to prevent Vermont's label law from going into effect, a law that he called, quote, a wrecking ball. Opponents urged lawmakers to vote against the bill to protect state laws and maintain transparency for consumers. The bill now moves to the full Senate, where it could be amended before the chamber votes. A U.S. House bill passed last year includes a paragraph that watchdogs call a gift to agrochemical giant Monsanto. The bill, meant as a sweeping update to the 40-year-old Toxic Substances Control Act, included a clause that could nullify legal claims for damages from polychlorinated biphenyls, also known as PCBs. It would also block states from passing their own laws on PCBs. That could give Monsanto an out when it comes to hundreds of millions of dollars in potential lawsuits. The paragraph in the bill specifically mentions a section of the old law concerning PCBs. Monsanto manufactured nearly all of the PCBs produced from 1930 until the chemicals were banned in 1979 due to links with serious health problems. Six cities have sued Monsanto to recover costs to clean up pollution from PCBs and allege that the company was aware of the health risks when the chemicals were still in production. Attorneys general and environmental regulators from 15 states have demanded Congress change the bill's language. Another story about Monsanto, a group of scientists and environmentalists are calling for an independent review of the chemicals found in the Monsanto herbicide Roundup. They say the chemical mixed with other ingredients could contribute to the risk of cancer and is due for modern tests. Fred Fomsall is one of them. He's a professor emeritus of biological sciences at the University of Missouri.
You know, this is just, from my perspective, irresponsible on the part of the government that this is the most heavily used herbicide in the world, and we're relying on 40-year-old data.
A recent review by the European Union's Food Safety Authority found that glyphosate is unlikely to cause cancer in humans. In a statement, Monsanto said, quote, no regulatory agency in the world considers glyphosate to be a carcinogen, end quote. And grocery stores can officially stop labeling cuts of pork and beef with their country of origin. The federal government has wiped the controversial law that required those labels from the books. Kansas State University livestock economist Glenn Tonzer says regardless of labeling, imported meat is subject to U.S. food safety rules.
When we bring meat in, it still has to pass safety protocol by USDA, just like it does if it's produced here.
That's why meat companies argue the labels were unnecessary, but some ranchers wanted protection from foreign competition. Congress repealed mandatory labeling of beef and pork late last year after the U.S. lost a World Trade Organization dispute with Mexico and Canada. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has now made the repeal official, although labels are still unnecessary for poultry, fish, and a list of other foods. You'll find these stories compiled in the podcast post at eartheats.org.
And on Twitter, You can scroll through all the news stories that have crossed our desk this week and add your two cents while you're there. Search for Earth Eats. All right, Mark. Always a pleasure.
Anytime, Annie.
Farming isn't the business it was a few years ago. To get by, many farmers are taking on debt. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports on whether hard times are ahead on the farm and what that means for the rural economy.
This is the Lee Valley Auction, a big consignment auction that happens near Takema in northeast Nebraska. People are here buying and selling used farm equipment, everything from tractors to cattle gates. And it happens to be on the muddiest day of the year. It's fitting, though, because lately the ag industry has been wallowing in some bad news, and I wanted to come here to ask some farmers about it. Amanda Johnson and her husband raise cattle and crops near Scribner, Nebraska. She's at the sale to save money on used fence posts because making money looks tough.
It really depends on markets. Really, it does. It's, I'd say even if you can break even, that's pretty good for the markets right now.
Prices for corn and soybeans, the top Midwest crops, have been falling because farmers raised so much grain, and the slow global economy has brought down demand. To make ends meet, farmers are selling equipment they don't need and giving up leases on farmland they can't afford. Colton Joseph farms a few hundred acres with a friend around Louisville, Nebraska. He's 23 and just getting started, but the farm's too small to buy new equipment or make a living.
Granted, I would love to farm full-time, but you still got to pay your bills. If you got to go get a job at McDonald's to pay them, that's just what you got to do.
Joseph doesn't flip burgers. He actually works in the ethanol industry, but economists expect more farmers to look for extra work to stay in the black. And as money gets tight, farmers are borrowing more. Nathan Kaufman is an economist with the Kansas City Federal Reserve.
We're continuing to see pretty strong demand for farm loans, so that's primarily reflecting strong demand for short-term cash flow.
Kaufman says it's taken a few years, but farmers are burning through the cash they stashed away during the recent good times. Now they're borrowing to pay for essentials like seed and fertilizer. The result? Farm debt is projected to pass $372 billion this year. Adjusting for inflation, that's the most farm debt since the late 1970s, when the rural economy began to melt down. But Kaufman says today's numbers are not a sign of history repeating.
So the fact that farmland values are still holding up pretty well, and farmland as an asset is by far the biggest portion of the farm sector balance sheet, means that debt-to-asset ratios aren't rising too much because those values have stayed strong.
The debt-to-asset ratio he mentioned is a kind of barometer for farm finances. Land is a farmer's biggest asset. If his farmland is still worth a lot, he can sell parts of it to pay off debts and isn't at risk of default. Right now, the debt-to-asset ratio is well below what it was in the 80s farm crisis, and that's a good sign.
Like in the 80s, you didn't know if you're going to have a farm sale come the end of the year. I don't think we're anywhere close to that.
Jerry Catlett is a banker at Bruning State Bank in Bruning, Nebraska.
But that doesn't say there's not a few exceptions out there where there might be folks looking at that right now.
In other words, some farms might fail, but that doesn't make it a farm crisis. And that's partially thanks to taxpayers like you. Government supports could provide a backstop for some producers. Farm payments are expected to pay out 30% more this year than last year. But Scott Olson isn't counting on farm payment programs to help him stay viable. Olson is an auctioneer at Lee Valley and also farms around Takema, Nebraska. With planting season coming up, he says there will be a fine line between making money and losing it.
You know, you can't just quit for a year. You know, you've still got taxes to pay, family to feed. You've still got to work and try to make it work.
He'll plant his corn and beans and hope for the best. If you're not optimistic, he says, you're not a farmer. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Later, to Boulder, Colorado, where the debate over GMOs is heating up. Nicolette Hahn Nyman calls herself a lifelong environmentalist. She's worked at the Waterkeeper Alliance and the National Wildlife Federation. She's also a livestock rancher. She considers her work with cows an extension of her environmentalism. Her new book, Defending Beef, explains why. In fact, that was one of the driving forces behind writing the book in the first place, to recalibrate the conversation about raising cattle.
There's a lot that's being done wrong with cattle husbandry today, both in the United States and other parts of the world. But to me, the problems are not inherent in cattle or in beef. It's really human error.
When she says she's defending beef, she's not defending conventional feedlot operations. She's talking about well-managed grass-based farms. Nyman owns BN Ranch in Northern California. The cows on her ranch are completely grass-fed.
You know, the best place for them to be is in a situation where they're outdoors and they're grazing, they're exercising, and they're eating vegetation that they themselves are harvesting through their own grazing. And what humans should be doing is to be managing those cattle as much as possible in such a way that their impact on the land is similar to how wild animals once grazed around the world.
She explains that this is actually helpful to the natural world. Cows graze the entire time they're awake. They live in densely packed herds.
The reason that that's beneficial for an ecosystem when they're well managed is because their mouths are clipping the vegetation, and that's like what we would do in our gardens with pruning. That's number one. Number two, the hooves of the cattle, the key is good management. If they're not being managed correctly, the hooves can be a negative. But a well-managed grazing operation, the hooves are essential because they're actually pushing the seeds into the ground and they're pushing the vegetation into the soil. So the biological processes of recycling the nutrients that are in the plants and feeding the soil life happen better when you have that trampling of the hooves.
And then finally, there's the manure, which adds nutrients back to the soil. These three processes create a beneficial disturbance on the earth. Taking it a step further, she talks about this beneficial disturbance and how it can actually help mitigate climate change. Well-managed, grass-based cattle operations can actually help store carbon from the air in the soil.
And basically, it goes like this. The plants bring the carbon from the air into themselves through photosynthesis, and then through their root structures and through fungi that live around the roots, as well as another substance that was just discovered in 1996 by USDA scientists called glomalin, which is a substance that coats the roots of the plants. There are billions of transactions that are taking place in the soil around the roots of these plants, especially grasses. Grasses are the best for this, where the carbon is then exchanged for the nutrients, and the nutrients go to the plant, and the carbon goes into the soil. And with lots of glomalin in soil, that's only present in really healthy soils, the carbon is then encapsulated and stays in the soil.
That is, as long as the soil is not being plowed. You need undisturbed subterranean environments to successfully sequester carbon. Her book is meant to encourage farmers to reform their practices. So what can the consumer take from it? Buy grass-based animal products.
You know, I really encourage people to look in their communities for where they can get the dairy products and where they can get the beef, where the animals are actually on grass as much as possible. And the options are there. You often have to leave your grocery store to find it, but it's there.
Nyman admits that she's an insider. She raises cows, after all. Her book, then, is a constructive criticism of her industry. She hopes fellow ranchers will see her suggestions as a way to move forward.
Americans are cutting down on their beef. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but my point is, if the beef industry doesn't want, you know, this to continue, you know, to go down, they need to listen to the concerns of people in the environmental community and people in the health community, and really make sure that the practices that are being engaged in across the industry are matching people's expectations as far as animal husbandry and as far as land stewardship and in terms of the safety and quality of the meat that's produced. People are very clearly more and more saying they don't want chemicals and drugs in their food system. That is so clear. It's so loud and clear. And the mainstream beef industry is still not getting that message. So I'm really hoping my book will be received by the beef industry as a sort of a really constructive criticism of how to go forward in a positive way.
Nicolette Hahn Nyman is a rancher, an environmental attorney, and an author. Her new book is called Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. More from my conversation with her is at eartheats.org. Coming up.
So if you get those French breakfast radishes, go ahead and serve them whole. Just wash them well. Throw them on the plate. You can put a dish of butter and a pot of salt on the table.
We're on a radish kick lately. Daniel Orr fixes up a snack with one of the first veggies that will pop up from the spring garden. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. We've had spurts of unseasonably warm weather in the Midwest, and that has us eager for gardening season. It's coming, just maybe not yet. That is, unless you planted some cold, hardy crops way back in the fall, in which case you're likely still pulling food out of the ground. Carrots and turnips actually get sweeter when they mature in the cold, and many greens do just fine throughout the winter. Kale is one of those. Lightly cooked kale leaves today, seasoned with some Asian flavors.
All right.
Today we're using kind of a purple-ribbed curly kale. The stems are edible, and they're also great in soups. So if you have a bunch of stems and you don't want to use them in your main dish, you can chop them up and throw them in your next soup. You can throw them in pasta sauce. You could even make a gratin out of them where you steam the kale stems and then put a cream sauce over them, some cheese, and put those in the oven. Get it nice and crunchy on top, and you have a great way to use up those stems. What I always suggest if you're using the stems is cut them into small pieces because you're cutting through those fibers and it's going to be tender. You don't have to worry about having those long stringy pieces in. Okay, we're going to just kind of rough chop the kale. Again, kale has those little crinkly leaves, so it's a very good idea that you wash it really well because it can hold sand and dirt in it. And I always, when I'm washing greens, I use kind of room temperature to slightly warm water, and that seems to encourage the sand and the grit to come out of the lettuce. If if they're really kind of buggy, or if you pull them right out of the garden and they're, you know, maybe it's that little slug that's hanging out in there, you can put a little splash of vinegar in the water, and that will encourage those little pests to get out of your greens as well. Now we're going to do kind of an Asian kale dish, and so I've got a nice hot pan here. Okay, we're going to add some oil. We've got our garlic, our sesame oil, and that's going to really be nutty and toasty smelling. Okay, we're going to add our kale. And this you don't really need to cook too much. You're just wilting it. You want to keep that nice green color and crunchy texture. Okay, we're going to add our sesame seeds, a little bit of cracked black pepper, and we're going to add some tamari. We're just going to toss that and season it to taste. And I'm just going to give that a little taste. Okay, I've got that nice nuttiness and then the crunchy little seeds in there. And with that tamari, you really don't need much salt in it. So we're going to plate it up.
Consider stocking your fridge with tamari. It's one of Daniel's go-tos when he's cooking greens. This was garnished with some red pepper sauce and a lemon wedge. One more suggestion there. Let your guests add the acid right before they eat the dish. Adding it too early will dull the vibrant green color. So find a picture and the recipe on our website, along with this one. As you write up your garden to-do list, make sure to plan on radishes. They like cooler weather and plenty of sun, and depending on which variety you choose, you could be eating them in a month. Simple to grow and best enjoyed simply.
All right, well, simplicity is everything in good cooking. I think that, you know, 90% of being a great chef is being a good shopper and 10% not screwing up what you bought. So the radish, the old French radish and butter sandwich is about as simple as you can go. We're going to fancy it up just a little bit. I've got my great-grandmother's biscuit recipe we're going to use instead of bread, but you could use any kind of bread. And I'm just going to slice those into some rustic chunks, kind of fan those out on a plate. And, you know, I think that, you know, your plates and your silverware and everything, the way you set a table really kind of sets the tone for your whole meal. So if you have some of grandma's plates, even if, you know, it was a set of 12 and now it's, you know, 7, when you have 6 people over, go ahead and use them. They're meant to be used, meant to be enjoyed. And I think that we honor our past by using our grandparents' dishes. And if you didn't know your grandparents that well, just go to a flea market and buy some fun old stuff. You usually can get it fairly cheap. And you won't really care if you break them that way. Okay, I'm just going to put a nice, real nice slab of butter. I mean, this isn't something where you're going to be meek with your butter. And use a good creamery butter. I use unsalted because we're going to be using the sea salt, and we're going to be using Himalayan sea salt. And if you've seen that before, it's got that nice pink color. For the radishes, I'm going to cut them into julienne, which means little matchsticks. And that just makes them look pretty, and you can stick them on the toast easier that way. So we're just going to mound those up on those biscuit croutons. Great little appetizer. Sprinkle them with the sea salt. And what it gives you is that real saline punch. That crunch and that punch is what I like to say. Gives you that little saline fix that everybody loves, but you don't need to use a lot of salt in the rest of your cooking. You just finish with it. So those are our little French breakfast radish croutons. I'm garnishing it with a little local kale and some dill. You could even put a few chive flowers or chopped chives on top. Yeah, the flies I probably wouldn't use. But the chopped chives right on top. And you got a lovely little starter, simple as can be.
EarthEats.org to follow the recipe. Genetically engineered crops, commonly referred to as GMOs, are lightning rods in discussions of the food we eat. For the farmers who grow them, they're a wonder of technology. For those opposed, the plants represent all that's wrong with modern agriculture. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon dives into a particularly heated debate and explains what we're really arguing about.
If you want a front row seat to the GMO fight, head on over to Boulder County, Colorado.
So the map.
Ron Stewart runs the county's open space program, more than 100,000 acres of pasture, forest trails, and farms. 1% of that land owned by the county is planted with GMO crops every year. But that could change. County officials are considering a ban of genetically engineered crops on county land.
The fundamental of this discussion is that this is land that is owned by the public.
The county buys up farmland and leases it back to farmers to preserve rural areas. In Boulder County, conventional farmland butts right up against headquarters for some of the largest organic food brands in the country. All that makes it the perfect place for these issues to come to a head.
The public, I think, rightly thinks it should have a significant input into what the practices are that we would have on open space land.
My name is Mary Smith. What's the best way to explain this? I'm a concerned citizen.
Smith is the head of a small group of activists here called GMKNOW, K-N-O-W. What she's currently concerned about is genetically engineered Roundup Ready corn and sugar beets grown in Boulder County.
Those lands are not being utilized for the benefit of the people of this community. Instead, they are being mined by conventional agriculture for commodity crops that are sent outside of this community.
Smith lists her concerns about organic farmers struggling to compete, agrochemical companies amassing economic power, pesticides seeping into streams. All issues in their own right, but not directly tied to seeds that have been genetically engineered. As the conversation goes on, we end up further away from GMOs altogether. I stop and ask her, when we think we're talking about GMOs, are we really talking about them at all?
This is not about GMOs, and this is not about inputs. This is about our right to have access to good, healthful food.
GMOs are a physical, tangible manifestation of a much larger set of economic and political concerns.
So I certainly think it's true that GMOs have become symbolic of something much larger.
That's Will Tour, a former Boulder County commissioner.
And I don't think they're a very good symbol of that.
Tour sat on the county board the last time this issue came up 5 years ago. After a public hearing that went until 4 in the morning, the board voted to allow cultivation of GMO sugar beets. Tour says the intense focus on genetic engineering misses the point. He'd rather see people organizing for better water efficiency, soil health, and adaptation to climate change.
But to me, those are the interesting questions, and they have almost nothing to do with GMO or non-GMO, or even organic or non-organic.
Luke?
I'm Luke, yeah.
I'm Famer.
Hey, Famer, nice to meet you.
I'm Jules.
Hey, Jules, nice to meet you,
too. Nice to meet you, too.
Farmers Jules Van Tine and Famer Rasmussen lease some of the county's land to grow GMOs. For them, the crops are more than a symbol. They say the plants are another tool in a toolbox to raise a profitable crop.
I mean, I think it becomes more of a social issue or a fear issue. And, you know, we're not afraid or ashamed at all to tell our story because what we think we are doing, we're very, very proud of.
Van Tine says a ban on GMOs would upend his operations.
These aren't corporate farms. These are farm families that have been here for several generations that their livelihood is very much affected by this decision.
Ultimately, what happens to 1,000 acres of farmland on Colorado's Front Range won't tip the scales in the much larger national debate about GMOs. But it could speak volumes about the divide between urban and rural communities. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Business doesn't know the impact of the GMO.
More stories like these are posted at harvestpublicmedia.org.
Genetic insanity.
A big thanks to all the reporters at Harvest for their stories about farming in America. Thanks also to our online experts, Aya Bonbinder and Betsy Shepard. Chad Bouchard and Mark Chilla work on the news blog. And Daniel Orr heads up our recipes. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. One last nod to the website. It's the place for interviews, news, and recipes, eartheats.org. All right, thanks for being here. I'm Annie Corrigan.